Welcome to Property Litigation Bites by Hargan Wolf, delivering the latest analysis of property litigation trends to UK landowners, developers, landlords, and tenants.
Hello, I'm Matt Pugh, Managing Partner at Hargan Wolf. This episode forms part of our Neighbourly Issues and Construction series of podcasts, which looks at navigating the complex legal challenges that can arise during a property development project with neighbouing landowners. Me and my fellow partner and property litigation solicitor, Sharon Matteson, discuss how to identify and manage these issues before they escalate into costly damages, injunctions and delays. Today, we look at restrictive covenants. What are they? Why is it important to be aware of them when planning a development? And what issues might they cause for a developer?
Okay, so Matt, what are restrictive covenants and why are they important?
A restrictive covenant is something that restricts what you can use land for, often what you can build on it. So you might have a covenant, for example, that says you can only build a single dwelling house, or it might say that you can't build anything above a certain height. Other covenants might say that you have to obtain the approval of someone else, the person perhaps with the benefit of the covenant, to specific things that you want to build. And these covenants tend to arise when there's a sale of part. So, for example, if you had a house with a large garden and you wanted to sell part of your garden to a neighbour, you might be quite happy to get some money for that garden land, but you might not be so happy if a neighbour then decides to build a massive house or even a block of flats at the end of your garden. So in that sort of scenario, it's pretty common for a restrictive covenant to be created to limit what the new owner of the garden can do with land. And that is something that's been the case for many hundreds of years. Other restrictive covenants affect what you can use the land for, usually to protect something. So, for example, if you had a pub with a large car park and you decided to sell part of the car park to somebody, you might have a restrictive covenant created at that time saying you can't use the pub car park as a pub because you don't want a competing business in your backyard. And so covenants tend to be created in order to protect something that was important at the time that the covenants were created. But obviously, as time passes, what is important changes. So why are restrictive covenants important? Well, if you are building and you ignore restrictive covenants, various unpleasant things can happen. The worst possible outcome is an injunction. So if those people who have the benefit of the covenant, who own land with the benefit of the covenant, are able to obtain an injunction, then that could force you to stop your building project when you're halfway through. It might stop you doing it in the first place. And potentially, it could even be requiring you to take down buildings that have already been fully built, maybe even let out already, and maybe even occupied. And in fact, there have been High Court decisions where exactly that has happened. But even the having to stop work at an unplanned time on a development can be very problematic. Any delay is going to likely cost the developer money. You'll have funding in place to build. There'll be repayments to make. And if there's delays, that can be very expensive. You'll have contractual arrangements with the builders who are actually doing the work. And if they're delayed, then there'll no doubt be penalties to pay as part of that. And obviously, if you pre-let the building, or even worse, your tenants have moved in, there's going to be all sorts of difficult things that come out of them being affected as third parties. Even if there's not an injunction on the cards, then breach of restrictive covenants can give rise to a damages claim. Exactly how you calculate that is fairly complex, but potentially a damages claim could be worth up to a third of the development profit on a development site. So potentially very large amounts of money, particularly if you haven't budgeted for it. So it's very important to be aware of these things early on. If you acquire land with a restrictive covenant, it's obviously going to limit what you're doing in the first place. And if you're selling land with a restrictive covenant, it is going to put off a lot of buyers. Any decent conveyancer should be identifying the existence of a covenant advising their purchase to clients, and it will put some of them off. It is possible to get insurance against the risk of claims being made, but it's going to, at the very least, affect insurance premium costs that would have to be paid, perhaps even create a renegotiation of the price, and perhaps even kill the transaction altogether.
Restrictive covenants are clearly important for developers. How can you identify a restrictive covenant, Matt?
So identifying a restrictive covenant on the burden land or the development land is often quite easy. On the land with the benefit, on the other hand, it's quite different. If the burden land is registered land, and most of the land in the UK is registered at the land registry, then the restrictive covenant should be noted on the title somewhere. So a look at the title to the development land by someone who knows what they're doing should reveal the restrictive covenant or the possibility of a restrictive covenant. And then the specific deeds that created the restrictive covenant can then usually be ordered from that. So relatively easy to see for the developer if the land is registered. Weirdly though, not so with those with the benefit of the land. It's very unusual for the benefit of a restrictive covenant to be noted on the titles of those with the benefit of it. And consequently, many people who have the benefit of a covenant have absolutely no idea that they do, which creates an interesting dynamic. And the only way of actually working out who they are, essentially, is to track the covenant back to when it was created, which is probably in a transfer of part, a bit like the sort of sale of your garden example that I talked about before, and to look at that covenant and look at the retained land and look at the land that's said to have the benefit of the covenant. At the time, that's probably or might just be one piece of land, but fast forward 100 years, they could have been multiple plot sales, and now there might be dozens and dozens of different people all with the benefit of that covenant. With unregistered land, it's a bit more complicated. And as I said, most land is registered. But with unregistered land, you've got to look at the deeds. So with a covenant that is really old, i.e. older than January 1926, all you can do is look at the deeds to see whether it was created. If the covenant was created after the 1st of January 1926, then you can do what's called a Class D2 land charge against the name of the original covenantor, person who gave the promise not to build or whatever it is. And that should flag up any restrictive covenant that might apply. But it's much more difficult on unregistered land. But the important thing is to check this really early on before you buy the land, certainly not whilst you're building on it, and you don't want to be sort of reacting and being surprised partway through a project with someone raising this sort of issue.
So how do you know if a restrictive covenant is enforceable?
That's a really important question. The idea behind restrictive covenants is that they're supposed to run with the land. So they're not supposed to just benefit the original parties to the deed, even if that's 100 years ago. They're supposed to run with the land so that at all times in the future, the owners of those particular pieces of land can enforce it or are bound by it. The thing is, though, that doesn't always go according to plan. And that is where the legal analysis comes in and becomes very important. If you're dealing with the original parties to a covenant, which usually you're not, then the answer is usually quite straightforward in terms of it being enforceable. But if you're looking at subsequent owners, you've got to look at whether benefit and the burden have passed. The burden passes relatively easily, but there are places that the benefiting parties can trip up. So, for example, if it's unregistered land or was unregistered land on the 1st of January 1926 and it's not registered as a land charge, that can basically scupper the whole thing. In terms of the benefit, then there's a number of different ways that the benefit of a covenant can pass. There might be a chain of deeds of assignment, assigning the benefit of the covenant each and every time the land has been sold on. But that's quite unusual. The covenant might be part of something called a building scheme, where there was maybe a new housing estate and lots of identical covenants were created, benefiting and binding all the different homes to make sure, for example, that they all retained a certain look and feel or didn't become overdeveloped. And when there is a building scheme, then the covenant sticks around. But the most common way is through something called statutory annexation, where the benefit of the covenant passes under statute, but it does require the covenant to be particularly clear. So it's got to be clear at the time the covenant was created, based on the wording of the covenant, any plan attached to it, and any maps or other sort of evidence that was knocking around at the time, what the land is that has the benefit of it. It needs to be defined. If it's really clear what it is, then that's okay. But if it just said, you know, for the benefit of homes in the area, that's going to be too vague. But if it says, you know, for the benefit of, you know, Land Edge Red, for example, that's much clearer. So the benefit and the burden is the place to look when it comes to the enforceability of covenants. There's also the question of what the covenant means. It's not always the case that what you want to do is prohibited by the covenant. It could be that you could redesign what you want to do so that it doesn't offend the covenant. For example, if it's talking about how high a building should be. So it's important to understand what the covenant actually means, and it could be ambiguous. There could be more than one meaning, and that needs to be looked at too.
So, Matt, how do you know who can enforce a covenant?
Well, it involves looking at the transfer or the deed that created the covenant back in the day, and that could be a long time ago, maybe 100 years ago, but most likely it's a sale of part, and you're looking at the retained land. So when that sale of part took place, what was the retained land? Can we draw like a red line around it? How does the deed describe the land with the benefit of the covenant? Can we draw a line around that? And then you fast forward into the present day to see who owns that land. Chances are there's been dozens and dozens of sales of part in the meantime, and lots of different people own that land. And the person who originally created the covenant's long gone, and half of them probably don't even realise they've got the benefit of the covenant, which is, you know, quite important in the sense that knocking on the door and tipping them off is not always the best thing. So often it is possible to work out who has the best benefit of the covenant. It just involves a bit of detective work.
Okay, so what can a developer do if they are worried about a restrictive covenant?
Well, firstly, they should be looking at this stuff super early, really before they acquire the site, and certainly before they commit to any major expense on the development or enter into funding, just in case that it's insurmountable. One of the really useful fixes to a certain point is insurance. It is possible to insure against the risk of restrictive covenants being enforced. And important to remember that if you decide to sort of knock on the door of those with the benefit of the covenant, inadvertently tipping them off, you might find out that you can't get insurance. So insurance is something to look at quite early on. But if at that time you're approaching the insurer having done the legal analysis with a benefit of legal advice, particularly if that legal advice is that the covenant isn't enforceable or might not be enforceable or might only be enforceable by one out of 30 people or something, you'll probably find that A, you've got more chance of getting cover, and B, you'll get a better offer than you would if you just went to them cold. So insurance is very important to look at, but insurance is only a policy. It will have exclusions, there'll be a premium to pay, there will be an excess to pay. And so it's not a magic wand. And insurance is not going to stop someone getting an injunction and pulling a building down. It might just pay you money. It might pay for a legal defence to a point, but it's not a magic wand. There are other things that can be done with or without insurance. One is negotiating with those with the benefit of the covenant. If you can negotiate something called a deed of release, that will effectively delete the covenant as between the parties to that deed of release. If there's only one or two people with the benefit of the covenant and you profile them and they're sort of kind of fairly ordinary folk who are not likely to want to get involved in expensive litigation, that has the ingredients of maybe doing a deal. But if on the other hand, you've got 50 or 60 people, particularly some of them are likely to fight it, that looks less attractive as an option. Other options include applying to court for a declaration that the covenant's not enforceable, assuming, of course, that the advice you have that it isn't enforceable. Approaching these parties, saying to them, inviting them to acknowledge that it's unenforceable to enter in a deed of release can be useful in the sense that if you obtain a court declaration and they turn their noses up at the opportunity of agreeing that, they could potentially be liable for the costs of that application. And also, very usefully, there are applications that can be made under Section 84 of the Law of Property Act 1925 to the Lands Chamber, which is a form of tribunal, which has the power to modify or completely remove restrictive covenants if you can establish certain grounds. Two of the grounds, the most common, one is where the covenant is obsolete. So typically, if it's an older covenant, it's maybe more likely to be obsolete. But you're looking at, why was the covenant created? What's it trying to protect? And is the thing it's trying to protect still relevant in the present day? So if we go back to my pub car park example from earlier, if you were to sell the pub car park with an restrictive covenant saying you can't build a pub on it 100 years ago, and fast forward to today, the original pub is now a block of flats, that covenant would be obsolete because its purpose is to avoid someone having a competing business in their backyard, and that would almost certainly be set aside. In a similar way, if covenants are designed to protect, say, crowded urban environments from being created at a time when it's very sparsely built out, but fast forward 100 years and it's a dense built out urban environment, then it may be obsolete. And the other ground, which is quite important, is this idea of reasonable use that is not going to sort of cause anybody any significant harm. There's a presumption, if you have planning permission, that your use is reasonable because it's been tested through the planning process. So if you have planning permission, that's one box ticked. And then you're really into, is what your development, is it going to cause any sort of real tangible, measurable problems for other people? Is it going to create a big increase in traffic or badly affect people's privacy or cause lots of noise or nuisance? Or is it going to devalue people's property? Is it any sort of meaningful way? Because if it isn't going to cause that much of an issue in reality, then you might be able to get the covenant relaxed to allow your development to go ahead, although you would end up having to pay compensation, which often is based on how much less are other people's houses worth with a form of uplift. And again, if there's only a couple of people affected, that might stack up. But if there are hundreds of people affected, that could be a very expensive compensation bill. So there are a range of things that developers can do about restrictive covenants. Some of them can work. The important thing is to look at these things early and to act early, not have to react to neighbouring landowners getting stuck in when you're halfway through developing and causing the issues with that.
Thanks, Matt. That's hugely beneficial just to get a better understanding of restrictive covenants. Thank you.
Thank you for joining this episode of the Property Litigation Bites podcast. If you have any concerns or questions about neighbourly issues arising from construction, please email hello@hargumwolf.co.uk. You could also find both of us on LinkedIn. Just search Matt Pugh or Sharon Matteson.
Thank you for listening to Property Litigation Bites. Haag & Wolf is an award-winning UK law firm specialising exclusively in property litigation and disputes. If you would like to discuss any of the issues covered in this episode, please contact us at hello@haagandwolf.co.uk You can also find us on LinkedIn. Visit www.hargandwolf.co.uk for further insight and analysis.